From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Hey, folks, welcome to the show. I'm Brian Bello, 20th Century Guy, here with Ed Ayers.
You're 19th Century Guy.
And we got Peter here. Peter,
18th Century.
Today, we're going to talk about an American dream that's turned sour for a lot of people. Here's President Obama speaking earlier this year in Falls Church, Virginia.
And this housing crisis struck right at the heart of what it means to be middle class in America. Our homes, the place where we invest our nest egg, the place where we raise our family, the place where we plant roots in a community, the place where we build memories.
You know, President Obama taps into many powerful themes associated with home ownership.
Yeah.
And what he's telling us is that in many ways we define ourselves by the home in which we live.
And the way we define ourselves here at Backstory is to go back in time, give you the real story behind the story. I want to talk about the first president to really push for universal home ownership in America. No, Peter, it wasn't FDR. It was Herbert Hoover.
He felt that home construction and getting more people into homes, their own homes, could actually provide not just an economic benefit for the country, but a very, very important societal benefit.
That's Lauren Moulds. He's a historian at the University of Virginia studying Herbert Hoover. And Lauren says that Hoover's push for home ownership goes back even further than his presidency, back to the early 20s when Hoover was Secretary of Commerce. Hoover had a particular kind of person in mind when he was thinking about housing in the big city.
Foreign-born immigrants living in congested houses that are unclean and laborers who are considering Bolshevism.
So he and his buddies over Commerce begin to push. They want to get people out of the cities and into their very own suburban home.
They wanted to connect home ownership with owning the American dream.
To convince the American people what a good idea it is to own a home, Hoover starts a campaign called Better Homes for America. And in 1924, Better Homes for America holds a bunch of fairs all over the country to show people just how great this suburban life can really be.
People could show up and look at model homes built by local contractors, furnished by local businesses, with Girl Scouts in the kitchen who had arranged all the carpets and the chairs. Right on the front desk would have a pile of pamphlets about how to build a house, how to finance a house, how to furnish a house.
So, Brian, why does this movement to create new suburban houses emerge in the 1920s?
Well, it happens in the 20s, I think, because people have a little more money in their pockets. Mm-hmm. More and more people are looking around thinking about buying houses. And strange as it seems to us, people didn't really know how to go about doing that.
Thousands of people, at least from Better Homes estimates, came and toured model homes and got pamphlets and signed up for informational books. The next year, 1925, 1,800 communities had Better Homes weeks with an estimate of 3 million people. And so by 1928, almost 4,000 communities have Better Homes fairs and 4 million people attend them.
And it worked, or at least something worked, because across the 20s, home ownership rates went up from 41% to 46%. But more important than a 5% increase in the percentage of home ownership was the message that all Americans took away from this era. And that was, if you wanted to be a real American, you better own your own home.
I think Hoover actually could say it better than I could. The man who owns his own home has a happy sense of security. No man ever worked for or fought for a boarding house.
You know, even the least ironic among us would have to be struck by the irony of Herbert Hoover being the voice of everybody having a home in the 1920s. And then really just a few years later with the Great Depression and the crash, by the early 1930s, there are towns all over America made up of tents and shanties. And you know what they were called? Hoovervilles.
Pretty ironic, huh?
Yeah.
Today on Backstory, the history of home ownership, we're going to try to get a handle on another of its central ironies, and that's this. Home ownership is such a central tenet of the American dream of what it is to be a functioning member of our society, and yet most Americans for the majority of American history, have not been able to own their own homes. We're going to try to explain that.
So I got it. Herbert Hoover was really important in sort of driving home, so to speak, this ideal of home ownership. But, you know, you got to think, of course, about the 19th century. The 19th century was filled with the dream of owning a piece of property, of being able to be your own boss. And I have a piece of tape here to demonstrate just what I mean, and it needs only five words of introduction. Little House on the Prairie.
How much longer, Charles?
Till we settle? I don't know.
We crossed into Kansas 4 days ago. What are you looking for?
I'll know it when I see it.
But the children are tired, and the joy seems to have gone out of all of us.
It'll pass, Carolyn. We had no future where we were. It was a hand-to-mouth existence at best. I want more than that for you and the children. 160 acres free and clear from the government. Chance to plant and harvest my own crops, to be owing to no man. I want that.
So that 160 acres that Michael Landon so longingly describes, that actually has a real historical origin. It's actually an act of Congress. Peter, you probably even know about that.
Yeah. That's the 1862 Homestead Act. But you know, Ed, that goes back to the Land Ordinance of 1785. Yeah. That's when they started doing the checkerboard out there in the Midwest for the amusement of air travelers ever since. You just look down and there it is. It's all this geometry on the ground.
Yeah, that's a good point, Peter. This has a long history. The difference is that with the Homestead Act, they have certain requirements. First of all, you have to live on it for 5 years to really make it your home. And you have to make improvements on it.
Yep.
And with those kinds of requirements, you know, you really need ways to get all the equipment to build a house out there. You need the farming implements. You need a way to make a life.
Yep. I think I hear a choo-choo train.
That's right.
Down the track.
Exactly. There's one problem. This is the early 1860s, and you will also know this, Peter, that we're in the middle of the Civil War.
Yeah.
The U.S. government does not have a lot of spare cash lying around to invest in a railroad, and what they do have is land, lots of land that they've just repossessed from the American Indians. So the government turns to, as we would say today, the private sector. They figure they can give some of their land away to railroad companies who in turn can sell it for a profit and use that profit to build a railroad.
And Ed, when you say give some of that land, you mean give as in for free.
Yeah, you know, there's no free lunch, but there is free land. And we're not talking about a couple of acres here and there. This is a big time gift.
I mean, I'll just give you an example. The grant to the Northern Pacific is the equivalent of giving them the entire area of New England.
This is Richard White, an historian at Stanford and author of Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of America.
We could think of a state named Railroadiana, and it would be, I think, the third or fourth biggest state in the country after Alaska, Texas, and maybe Montana. That's how much land they gave to the railroads, all to private corporations.
Talk about corporate welfare.
Yeah, I know, Peter, but this time they really believed it was going to be a win-win because according to the plan, the government wouldn't actually be losing any of the value of the land.
They're giving it away, aren't they?
Yeah, they're giving away some of the land. Think of it this way. Imagine a checkerboard, as you did earlier, the airplane flying over it, but a picture, a real checkerboard with red and black squares, and the railroad is the crease down the middle. The government gives all the red squares to the railroad.
And what about the black squares?
Well, the government keeps those. Mm. And because those black squares are next to the red squares that the railroad has, they double in value as soon as the railroad is built.
Yeah, I understand this. You guys know I'm from Florida. I understand all about real estate speculation. But what's different about this is it's the government that's kind of speculating. They're hoping that the squares they hold on to are going to increase in value, right?
And they're going to put a railroad through the middle to make sure they do. Yeah. That's the whole idea. So now you'll have a railroad that will keep the country connected transcontinentally and help grow the economy and develop all those black squares. It sounds like a brilliant idea.
Yeah, in theory. But even though it's your century, Ed, it seems to me that people were pretty suspicious of the government back there. I mean, didn't some people protest the government simply giving away all this public land?
That's later. Okay, that does happen. But 1862, when this plan was first proposed, even the settlers say, you know, what a great idea. I mean, the railroads are what's going to make their dream of their own Little House on the Prairie possible. Here's Richard White again.
The homesteaders are commercial farmers. They're not out there to live off the land. They're out there to make money. And they know that once you get away from the rivers, you need railroads to make money. So they, as long as this worked as it planned, they are not raising a great deal of objections to it.
As long as this worked as planned, I sense storm clouds brewing on the horizon.
Well, the problem is, let's say you grant the land, but the railroad goes bankrupt, as the railroad does. Well, the railroad still holds all those red squares. There's no way it can sell them now. It's in bankruptcy. And sometimes the railroads don't build again for 5-10 years. You have a bunch of settlers who want to come in and settle, but the land isn't available to them. They have to move outside the railroad grant.
And when they move away from the railroad grant, it's obviously a lot harder to get their stuff to market.
And the other thing you should think about is that the railroads are actually going to put all the land up for sale. Well, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they use it to mortgage land grant bonds, and they pretty much keep the land, and the land's tied up and settlers can't get to it. So there's a whole series of ways in which this whole thing goes disastrously wrong until by 1873, there's no more land grants to railroads.
That quickly, that's only 11 years, basically, right, that it goes on?
Yeah, it's about 10 years too long, actually.
Okay, so what happens to all those would-be settlers then who want to go west, but they can't find any land?
Yeah, the ones who do get land, but the land is so far from the railroads that it's just not economically viable for them to get goods to market. Well, if you want to get all technical, the system doesn't actually work for them. And as a matter of fact, most of those would-be homesteaders don't make it. Only about a third of them last the 5 years required to get title to the land. The rest move on. Some try again elsewhere. Some call it quits and head back east. And thinking about this huge rate of failure, I mean, two-thirds, that's a lot. I had to ask Richard, how did those parts of the country recover?
Well, large parts never did. You know, the parts where it worked well up until the 98th meridian, those are pretty thoroughly settled by the 1890s. But once you move west of the Missouri River and then you go to the Sierra Nevadas, this huge area of the Great Plains, the Rocky Mountains, and the deserts, you know, this has been boom and bust country. And parts of this have still been losing population since the 1920s. So parts of this, you could argue, never did recover. This was a bad policy with very, very lasting consequences. And when you go to the empty sections of the United States, the places where there's small towns drying up in the Great Plains, the places where you'll see the land has been brought into huge ranches or large farms, you're looking at failed homestead country.
That was Richard White, an historian at Stanford University.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to give you a whole new definition of blockbuster. It has nothing to do with movies, but if it did, it might be the most depressing movie you've ever seen.
We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Backstory.
Welcome back to Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Bellow, 20th Century History Guy.
Jack McNamara.
And this is Jack McNamara. Today, we're talking about the history of home ownership in America. And back in the 1960s, Jack found himself in the middle of a home ownership story so complicated it could only happen in the 20th century, guys.
Yeah. What's so special about the 20th century?
Yeah, well, it'll be worth it, guys. I promise.
All right, Brian, lay it on me.
In 1967, Jack McNamara was a Jesuit seminarian, and he came to Chicago on what we might today call a mission trip. The local pastor wanted a bunch of young guys like Jack to each take a city block and basically just talk to the people there, find out what their problems were.
He called it Operation Saturation.
Jack thought it was a summer gig.
That summer project ended up to be about 4.5 years.
Jack was stationed in North Lawndale, a mostly African-American neighborhood on the west side of Chicago. Gray stone detached houses, each family sharing a wall with its neighbor. And the reason Jack spent so long there? It began with a conversation he had with a woman on his assigned block. Her name was Ozareya Arbertha.
I was sitting in her living room one night. She was a widow with 4 kids. And she was working at the post office, making $5,000 a year. Her mother was living with her. She was making $4,000 a year scrubbing floors at a hospital at night. And Mrs. Arbertha that night as we were sitting there, with a tear coming down her face, said, "I think I could make it if I didn't have this big mortgage payment." And I said, "How much is your mortgage payment?" And she said, $226 a month.
That surprised Jack. Just a couple of years before, he had been living in Skokie, a white suburb with homes that were by all accounts nicer than Lawndale's. And Jack's mortgage payments, well, they were $108, less than half of what Mrs. Arbertha was paying. To understand why Mrs. Arbertha's payments were so high, you need to understand what Lawndale was like a decade earlier. Back then, Lawndale wasn't an all-black neighborhood. It was an all-white neighborhood. But near the end of the 1950s, real estate speculators played on the racial fears of white homeowners. They spread rumors that a wave of blacks was poised to move in, a situation that would drag down property values and ruin the neighborhood. It was a process known as blockbusting. James Allen McPherson described the speculators' tactics in a 1972 issue of The Atlantic. Some merely hired black women to walk their children through white neighborhoods or paid black men to drive noisy cars through an area a few times a day. Sometimes it was a telephone call for Johnny May. Another caller might simply say, "They're coming." The whites sold, many at prices far below the appraised value of their homes.
A speculator would come in and buy a place from an outgoing white family for $15,000, for example. And then 2 days later, they would turn around and sell it to a black family for $28,000. You know, that wasn't all of it, because they were paying interest on an additional $13,000. So by the time they got through 20 years, they would have put in $25,000, $26,000 more. We refer to that total markup as a race tax.
The obvious question is, why would anybody pay double market value for their home? Why not just go somewhere more affordable? The most fundamental reason was that blacks were not welcome in most white neighborhoods. In many instances, there were stipulations in the actual deeds that restricted owners from selling to non-whites. As for renting, well, a lot of these families had enough of that.
I thought buying a house was a step up, you know.
This is Clyde Ross. Like many of the other new faces in Lawndale, he had grown up down south. He was a sharecropper in Mississippi.
Regardless of what it was going to cost me, I was going to try to make it up beyond, you know, the plantation-style situation.
In case you didn't catch that, he said he was trying to get beyond the plantation-style situation. So in 1961, he bought a home for $27,500, a home he later learned was worth only $15,000. But here's the kicker. Clyde applied for a mortgage to cover the inflated asking price. Despite having a job and being a first-time buyer, he was denied. And blame for that lies not with speculators, but with the U.S. government. In the 1930s, the government wanted to encourage homeownership, not just for the richest Americans, but for everyone. So the Federal Housing Administration, or the FHA, created a safety net for banks. They basically said, if you give mortgages to higher-risk, low-income borrowers, we'll guarantee those loans. And if those people default, it's the government's loss, not yours. The thing was, the FHA would only guarantee loans in certain neighborhoods.
The line in the underwriting manuals was that the introduction of an incompatible element to a neighborhood would deem that neighborhood to be too risky for a federally underwritten loan.
This is Tom Segrew, an historian at the University of Pennsylvania.
Incompatible elements meant ethnic or racial minorities. Any neighborhood with more than a handful of African Americans living in it was usually systematically excluded from those loan programs.
In a process known as redlining, the government drew up detailed maps to make these distinctions clear.
They also colored the maps, so the neighborhoods that were green and blue were rated the highest, the neighborhoods that were yellow, kind of risky, the neighborhoods that were red were deemed too risky for federally underwritten loans. And those neighborhoods were invariably neighborhoods with significant minority populations.
With mortgages off the table for so many African Americans, they were left with only one option to finance a house. It was called a land contract.
And these contracts essentially made homeownership very difficult to obtain. I mean, you miss one payment and the house would be repossessed and the speculator who bought it would put it on the market and sell it to somebody else. It was essentially a kind of a buying on installment plan.
Under a contract, you got all the responsibilities of homeownership without actually owning any equity in the house.
When you got a contract, you don't own the house.
Again, Clyde Ross.
You're just paying for it. And you're responsible for tax, insurance, upkeep, heat, lights, gas, and everything you're responsible for.
Jack McNamara discovered that hundreds of families in Lawndale had purchased their homes under these contracts. More shocking still was that none of them realized their neighbors were in the same situation. Everyone thought they were the only ones.
Most of them were embarrassed to have bought on contract. They would tell each other they had mortgages, but they didn't, you know, none of them did have mortgages. They would just.
So they referred to it as a mortgage.
Right. And mostly because, you know, it was embarrassing to have to admit that they had this inferior form of home ownership.
McNamara organized a meeting with about 10 families. That meeting turned into many meetings, and the 10 families turned into 500. The group gave themselves a name, the Contract Buyers League, or CBL. Their goal? To renegotiate the members' contracts, to lower the price of their homes, all 500 of them, to fair market value. Despite their numbers, there was an initial reluctance to act. A lot of these families had been paying their contracts for upwards of 10 years. That's a lot of money to lose if something goes wrong. Clyde Ross likened the situation to something he saw as a boy back in Mississippi.
When I was at home, I used to graze the cow. We had one cow. And so we put a chain on her leg and tarp, and we would put in places where she could keep grass twice a day. So one time I come back to move in another place and the chain was off. And the cow didn't even know it. The cow was still walking in the same area while she could eat. She didn't even know the chain was off. She was so blindfolded that she had been in the chain so long, she thought that the chain was still on her leg.
But Russ, like McNamara, knew that if something was going to change, it was going to change right now. Nobody liked contracts. They just needed a little convincing to fight back.
So my voice with them was, the chain is off, you know. Just move on out and do something else.
The CBL organized a payment strike. To be safe, the Lawndale families put aside the payments they would have made in a safe deposit box. If the renegotiations worked, they wanted to have cash on hand to cover the back payment.
What was cool was that we kept track of how much we had. And, you know, you came to $1 million pretty quickly. The night before the first eviction, we had a large crowd meet in a church there. And, you know, we could have paid right then. But people got up and say, well, night's darkest hour comes before the dawn. And we ain't got nothing no-how anyway. So everybody, you know, kind of remained resolved and in solidarity.
The CBL fought the eviction attempts that followed, sometimes in court, sometimes in more wily fashion.
At the beginning, we were able to get so many people inside the house that when the sheriff's guys came, they couldn't get in to remove the furniture. Stand in the house.
Stand in the house, and if they move the stuff, when they leave, we put the stuff back in.
Despite their creative tactics, the activists could only do so much, and at least 12 families were thrown out of their homes for good. But many were able to renegotiate, presumably as a result of the payment strike. By the end of 1970, 106 contracts had been renegotiated, with each family saving an average of $14,000. McNamara says that over the next several years, that number rose to 490 families, with an average savings of $13,500, putting them more or less on par with what a white homeowner with a mortgage would have paid. Clyde Ross was one of them. By the time he renegotiated, he had been making contract payments for a decade, so he didn't owe any more money on his house. Plus, he had all that money saved up from the payment strike.
She said, what are we going to do with it? Fix the house up. Bought me a new car.
A brown Chevy. And best of all, he got the deed to his house. He remembers that day very clearly.
Oh, man, it was an unbelievable date, you know. It was unbelievable that I can walk in his house and say, well, I own this house and I ain't got to pay no mortgage next month.
And then the chain was really off.
Oh, the chain was off. And after that, I couldn't sleep. Two or three nights, I couldn't sleep.
Clyde still lives in that house today, 50 years later.
Special thanks to Nyla Boudou, who helped us in the reporting of that story.
And to Beryl Satter, whose book, Family Properties, tipped us off to the story of the CBL. You can find a link to check out that book on our website, backstoryradio.com.